The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from National Geographic and the Washington Post. Before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, I want to remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we'll be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. On today's Armchair Traveler, we're going to go down under to learn about Australia's Great Big Camel Conundrum. Now, Sean Williams wrote this article. It appeared in the May 2025 issue of National Geographic. As one of the captions with the photos in the article explains, imported from the Middle East and Asia in the 19th century, camels now thrive in Australia's arid outback. But drought and climate change are raising tough questions about whether they belong. So let's find out exactly what's going on as we begin our journey today. Jack Carmody has built a sizable YouTube following by showing his viewers what it takes to run a cattle station in the Australian outback, the rugged work of mending troughs, reinforcing fences, and shooting trespassers. Feral horses and donkeys, that is, and one particularly destructive invasive species, camels. Introduced in the 19th century to help colonists survey the country's vast interior, the creatures are now wreaking havoc across the outback and decimating the Carmody family's ranch property, or what Australians call a cattle station. At more than 1,500 square miles, the property, Prenti Downs, is the size of Rhode Island, so there's plenty of work to be done, and in this modern internet age, there's plenty of content to be created. On Carmody's channel, Jack Out the Back, no videos are more popular than those focused on his fight against the camels, which the straight-talking father of three culls with his rifle, taking out nearly 800 each year. The approach might seem alarming, but to Carmody and other cattle farmers, it's simply the most rational solution to a dire problem, like weeding the veggie patch, as he puts it. And in a twist that is perhaps good for YouTube and bad for cattle farming, the camels, like stubborn weeds, keep coming back. Australia is now home to the world's largest feral camel population, with estimates from several hundred thousand to as many as a million. Females can give birth every 2 years and live up to 40 years in the wild, meaning the number of camels can double every 9 years. Weighing an average of 1,000 pounds, they roam in herds from fewer than 10 to several hundred, trampling ecosystems and destroying infrastructure. The creatures are voracious consumers of plants, competing with other wildlife and livestock, and limiting food sources for Aboriginal communities. They destabilize sand dunes, which can lead to erosion. Camels also foul water holes with their droppings or by mobbing them, only to die of thirst, their carcasses then poisoning what little water is left. Water, in fact, is the source of the biggest problem. When enough moisture-rich plants are available, camels, famously, can subsist for weeks on end without a drink. But when they do get thirsty, they're insatiable. An adult camel can consume 50 gallons in a day. When natural sources of water dry up on Aboriginal land, pastoral territory, and cattle stations, camels go looking for a drink wherever they can find it. In the process, they often rip up pipes, destroy toilet blocks, and knock air conditioners out of windows. What's even more concerning is that a rising number of droughts is pushing the animals into ever closer and more frequent contact with humans. One of the most damaging of these conflicts occurred in 2013 on a Northern Territory cattle station named Curtin Springs. 6 years earlier, feral camels, desperate for a drink, wrecked 100 miles of the station's fencing, and I mean just totally destroyed, says Lindy Severin, who runs the farm with her family. Gone. Replacing the fencing cost about $500,000, and ranchers have a legal obligation to remove feral animals on their property. When she saw the camels were back, Severin called the Australian Feral Camel Management Project, which had culled 27,000 camels from the region the previous year. Within 48 hours, snipers arrived at the property, and over the next 4 days, they shot 1,700 camels dead from their helicopters. But the federal camel culling program, budgeted for 4 years, ended in 2013 with little political will in cities to keep the distant Outback Project going. And feral camel numbers have only gone up. According to biologist Tim Lowe, co-founder of Australia's Invasive Species Council, a private nonprofit, the current impact of feral camels on farmers and rural Aboriginal Australians is very substantial. Cost and damage and control, last estimated at $12 million in 2013, are unknown today. Lowe and other experts say if they can't get the population under control, the country's next drought will lead to more crises. There are plenty of ideas, both practical and fanciful, for what to do with the feral camels, but it's helpful to understand why they were brought to Australia in the first place. In the 1830s, British colonists, struggling to survey the outback on horses that tired easily, got word of camels' extraordinary endurance. The first camel to enter the country arrived in 1840 from the Canary Islands, and others followed from Arabia, Afghanistan, British India, and the Persian and Ottoman empires. Colonists also brought in more than 2,000 camel operators, or cameleers, whom they collectively called Afghans, despite their disparate origins. Camels helped open the remote interior, transporting food and supplies, as well as gold prospectors and workers building railway and telegraph systems. Then the White Australia policy, enacted in 1901 to prevent non-Europeans from emigrating, began to thin the number of cameleers, as would technology. By the 1930s, cars and railroads had rendered Australia's camel industry all but obsolete. Many foreign cameleers returned to their homelands, and their camels, up to 10,000 of them, suddenly jobless, were set free to roam. One traditional use for these wayward animals is to enlist them in the camel trekking industry, which offers a ruggedly authentic way for travelers to see some of the most remote parts of Australia's interior. Camel trekking was made famous by Robin Davidson's 1980 memoir, Tracks, about her solo 1,700-mile journey by camel across the deserts of Western Australia, and the industry now comprises a dozen operators. One of the longest running is the Outback Camel Company. Andrew Harper, who has owned the outfit since 2000, has 21 camels. Estimates that that fewer than 100 camels around the country are being used for trekking. We've governed by the season, says Harper, and with limited numbers of people wanting to make desert treks, it's not like your normal business model focused on exponential growth. But there's also a more dramatic way to ride feral camels, one that, like the animals themselves, has been imported from abroad. Each year, more than 4,000 people visit the Queensland village Boulia, population under 400, which hosts one of Australia's most famous camel racing tournaments, a competition where the purse totals some $30,000. The animals are temperamental. Few heats pass without a buck or a bite, and any jockeys worth their salt have their scars to prove it. Every single camel has gotten a different personality, says jockey Bretland Beaver Neal. You hope you get a good start, and yeah, hold on. Camel trekker Paddy McHugh founded the Boulia Camel Races in 1997. It remains a modest enterprise, as does the entire domestic racing circuit, which is only about 100 camels in competition. But McHugh thinks that figure could grow tenfold. A Formula One-style circuit could connect Australian races with contests in North Africa and in the Persian Gulf, where racing camels can be worth over $1 million. In Saudi Arabia, perhaps the sport global capital, the 2024 Crown Prince Camel Festival featured more than 21,000 camels and a staggering prize pot of $15 million. McHugh is a realist, though, and thinks the only way to solve Australia's camel problem is to market the creature's varied attributes. The camel is so underrated, he says, we need to lift that profile and make it another great industry for Australia. Opposed to culling, like some Aboriginal communities and animal welfare groups, he's upset by the mindless slaughter of this great animal. Camels are remarkably versatile. Unlike most other animals that you can race up to 40 miles an hour, they can also be milked. Camel milk, which is creamy and slightly salty, offers a nutritious low-fat and low-lactose alternative to cow's milk. Australia's camel milk production, 50,000 gallons a year at last available count, is a drop in the proverbial bucket compared with 634 million gallons in cow's milk sales today. But it's an emerging cottage industry. The Camel Milk Company, founded north of Melbourne in 2014, now has a milking herd of more than 200 at its dairy. Summerland Camels, an organic farm in Queensland where 800 camels graze, vaunts the benefits of the vitamin C-rich milk and offers a range of other dairy products from feta to gelato, body cream to milk vodka. Elsewhere in Queensland, Q Camel is producing camel's milk chocolates. There are, of course, significant challenges to scaling these operations to such a degree that they could make a dent in the country's huge feral population. As Warwick Hill of South Australia-based camel dairy Humpalicious explains, animals bred for milking typically have uniform tit and udder sizes. Nobody's made any serious efforts to breed camels for conformity to machinery, he says. The time it takes us to milk a dozen camels, a cow dairy could probably be putting through 500. One of Humpalicious's products, jerky, points toward another potential solution, camel meat, which is a $1.6 billion global enterprise. An industry report projects it will swell to $2.2 billion by 2030, with major markets in the Middle East and Africa. Camel meat is already having a moment. An episode of the new Australian TV show Eat the Invaders urged viewers to try it. Businesses already taking advantage of the demand include artisanal enterprises and large firms such as Samax, a meat exporter in Adelaide, and New South Wales Fetala Foods, a wholesale and retail meat product supplier for the domestic market that offers camel burger patties. Like camel dairy, camel meat is a niche business in Australia. Its camel meat industry produces a few hundred tons a year, a far cry from the nearly 3 million tons of beef it produces. But Eddie Hopkins, CEO of Camel Export Australia, says there's a growing demand abroad for the country's camel meat, particularly in the United States. He's fielded requests for more than 25 tons a week, about 200 camels worth, from grocers in Minneapolis, Minnesota, home to a large Somali community for whom the animal is a staple source of meat and milk. Hopkins thinks those requests are just scraping the surface and believes the actual weekly demand globally to be closer to 1,200 camels, making him optimistic about the industry's long-term prospects. Carmody, the rancher and YouTuber, also hopes to sell some of the 130 tons of camel meat that his culls could yield annually. In one recent video, he slices off the fatty hump of a dromedary to access the meat underneath it, explaining he sometimes also makes cuts from the legs and shoulders for sausages. But it's a lot of work, and he wonders whether enough customers will be willing to pay the necessary premium. After all, it's painstaking and expensive to cull the animals in the desert and transport them for processing. It's just horrendously cost prohibitive, Carmody says, and it's cheaper just to shoot them all. A number of experts agree that a commercial camel meat industry could never reach the scale needed to solve the problem. Biologist Tim Lowe of the Invasive Species Council argues that focusing on industries that harvest camels will only create resistance to necessary culling, which he sees as the sole practical solution. Carmody, for his part, says he can't even cull camels efficiently with semi-automatic weapons, thanks to a statewide ban on the firearms that's been the subject of several jack-out-the-back videos. I'm letting everyone know exactly what's going on and how we are supported, he says. We're being told that we're a threat to society if we have access to tools to do the job, but we're actually doing something we have to do. Recently, Carmody was flying up from Australia's southern coast toward home when less than an hour into the flight, he spotted a small herd of camels heading toward a farming zone. It's not just an outback problem, he says. It's going to start becoming a problem down on the coast. But for now, now, it's Outback cattle stations like Carmody's and Severn's that remain at the heart of the crisis. To keep feral camels in check, Severn holds about 50 at a time that she's rounded up until they are mature enough to be sold for slaughter. "We don't like to shoot to waste," she says, "but her patience is wearing thin, and she fears another clash is on the horizon. It's not if they'll come back," she says. "They will come back. The real question is what inhabitants of the Outback are prepared to do about it." Boy, what an interesting story, and I suspect we will hear more about that issue in the coming months here on Armchair Traveler. In the meantime, let's move on to another interesting topic. While the Australians are trying to decide how to handle troublesome camel populations, the people of France are debating another issue. It's called a digging issue, and more specifically, who gets to dig for dinosaurs? It's written by Scott Johnson and appears in the May 2025 issue of National Geographic. Now, as the introductory page explains, the French countryside is rich in fossilized eggs, footprints, and bones. A battle is raging over who's allowed to hunt for them. Let's go to the story. One scorching day last September, Annie Mishan crouched over a slab of red clay on a remote patch of farmland near Marseille on France's Mediterranean coast. Mishan was scraping away at the clay when she unearthed what looked like a tiny bone fragment. Sensing familiar jolt of adrenaline that surged any time she came across a fossil, she called out to her husband Patrick, who was digging nearby. Carefully, the two amateur paleontologists, both retired and in their 60s, cleared the surface area, dug a small trench around the bone, and fashioned a plaster mold for the scientific record. By the time night fell, the Mishans had two more moles and a growing sense of excitement that they might be onto something big. It was a consecration of the work we do, says Patrick. Indeed, leading experts would soon tout the potential significance of their find. But the discovery came at a tricky time for paleontology in France, where there are efforts to keep the couple and all other amateurs out of the digging game. Once simmering, the debate over who gets to hunt for dinosaur fossils has become a roiling fight over credentials. On one side, French officials and scientists fed up with the looting and an international black market where fossils can fetch top dollar. On the other side, hobbyists working with professionals to protect and catalog the country's geologic patrimony, filling museums with specimens that only hordes of enthusiasts could possibly collect. Each side accuses the other of being anti-science, both sides having evidence to back themselves up, and it's a conflict that is becoming only more urgent as the country's paleontological wealth is increasingly understood. France was once filled with dinosaurs. Today it has one of the most extensive fossil records in Europe, ranging from the late Triassic period to the late Cretaceous, roughly 200 million to 75 million years ago. Fossils were first discovered in the country in the 18th century, but interest in paleontology was turbocharged in the 1950s when researchers found a large cache of dinosaur eggs in the stony foothills of Montagne-Saint-Victoire. Now, a raft of scientific and newspaper articles followed, and within months, people swarmed the area around the city of Aix-en-Provence, soon nicknamed Aix-en-Provence, in search of their own scaly orb, roughly the size and shape of a football. A clandestine market emerged. A single specimen might sell for a few thousand francs, the equivalent of several hundred euros today. In response, authorities cracked down, and in 1994 turned Saint-Victoire into a nature reserve. But dinosaur eggs kept cropping up. Between 2000 and 2004, researchers in Exxon uncovered 500 or so at a plot that would become a Monoprix retail store, and more than 400 eggs were found underneath the Grand Theatre de Provence. Now, professional paleontologists, many busy with research, were unable to constantly look for new fossils. Amateurs increasingly filled the void. In the 1980s, the Mishans dug up a massive jawbone of an absolorid, a dinosaur that until then had only been found in South America. In 2022, an amateur digger discovered what turned out to be a nearly complete titanosaur in a wooded area by the town of Creuset in southern France. Many of these hobbyists, including the Mishans, follow paleontological methods when they dig and then share their discoveries with the scientific community. Earlier this year, two amateur paleontologists in southwestern France uncovered several hundred noteworthy fossils from the Ordovician period, some 470 million years ago. Their finds quickly became the subject of an academic study among scientists at the University of Lausanne in Switzerland. But there's big money to be made in the fossil trade, and some diggers are less scrupulous. Tierra Tortosa, a curator and paleontologist at the Saint-Victoire National Nature Reserve, has helped a few hobbyists authenticate their finds, only to discover later that the items were sold on the black market. Specialist in vertebrates of the Upper Cretaceous period, he says he is aware of private collections that are worth hundreds of thousands of dollars, but there are surely some worth much more. In November 2024, an Apatosaurus skeleton found in Wyoming was sold to an anonymous bidder for $6 million at an auction in Paris. In 2023, a T-Rex known as Trinity was sold in Zurich for $5.4 million. Museums can't afford these price tags. Even if they could, purchasing the finds would open a Pandora's box, Tortosa says. If we start buying fossils, everyone will say, well, we won't give it away because someone will buy it. Most often, fossils disappear from the public record with much less fanfare than a public auction. One particularly valuable site in Roquefort-la-Beaudelaye on the French southern coast has been repeatedly pillaged by looters. It's a ruin now, laments Tortosa. 90% of private collections, is said, are sold, lost to fire, or simply abandoned. In one report, the French National Council for the Protection of Nature found France's geologic patrimony had been heavily impacted by the collection of fossils. In Normandy, the situation is especially tense. For centuries, locals have been collecting 160 million-year-old Jurassic period fossils, ammonites, and other treasures from the beaches below the sheer cliffs of Calvados, where some of the first dinosaur remains in France were found. For the time being, they still can, but the French government has plans to transform the area into a 23-mile nature reserve, a measure designed in part to place restrictions on who is allowed to dig at the site. If the proposed regulations are enacted, anyone caught collecting fossils without permission could incur a 750 euro fine. Karine Bourdier, a director of the local natural history museum, Paleospace, has described the government's efforts as the assassination of paleontology in Normandy. In protest, her team placed red flags on every dinosaur specimen that had been collected by an amateur. Virtually the entire collection, some 27,000 fossils, were flagged. Lorraine Puglisi, a doctor from Paris and an ardent amateur collector himself, argues that the Calvados cliffs represent a unique challenge. It's a seafront area, so if the fossils aren't collected right away, they'll be turned into sand in a matter of hours, he fumes. Collecting them is preserving them. Puglisi is also spearheading an effort to persuade local and national authorities to relent. To little effect so far. Now, Eric Bouffetat, a paleontologist at France's National Center for Scientific Research, echoes Puglisi's concerns. If we prevent amateurs from collecting fossils, well, there won't be any new fossils. Already, he says, parts of Provence have become a research wasteland because of overly strict regulations. Meanwhile, the Mishans have been fortunate. Their discovery in Provence near Marseille last September took place on a tract of private land whose owner had given them permission to continue their research. After their initial find, the couple returned to the site four times and eventually uncovered several more fossils belonging to the same dinosaur. The collection of rust-colored bones could answer a mystery that has been bubbling in French paleontological circles for more than 30 years. In the late 1980s, the Mishans had discovered a similar set of bones in another region of Provence. Bouffetat studied the fossils and concluded they belonged to a chicken-sized raptor with a hooked talon that lived at the tail end of the Cretaceous period, just a few million years before dinosaurs went extinct, roughly 66 million years ago. Patat, a co-authored a paper about the discovery and declared a new raptor species, naming it Veroraptor michinorum, in honor of the Michins. Soon, a team of scientists from Paris disputed the new designation, claiming the bones likely belong to a different raptor species, and Veroraptor michinorum has been shrouded in ambiguity ever since. The Michins' new find could provide the missing pieces to help resolve the mystery, says Tortosa, who has examined the discovery. Yet, despite his collaboration with amateurs, Tortosa favors increased regulation and better enforcement of existing rules over who is allowed to dig. Regulation doesn't necessarily mean prohibition, he says, but France also shouldn't be a Wild West where anything goes, he adds. One day recently, the Michins opened the door to a small room in an undisclosed location that houses their collection. The fruits of four decades of digging, passing shelves that hold crocodile and alligator craniums, a giant turtle carapace, and dozens of dinosaur teeth, an ankylosaurus pelvis, and numerous fragments of titanosaurus. And Patrick and Annie pause next to a table covered by a half dozen fossils. No entire skeleton of Veroraptor michinorum has ever been found, but the specimens laid out on the table that included a tibia, a piece of a cranium, teeth, an arm fragment, and portions of a vertebrae represented perhaps the most complete collection to date. We're not religious, said Patrick as he looked around the room, but this is like our church. Well, we're going to conclude our journey on today's Armchair Traveler with a short article, The Miracle of the Sole Passenger Who Survived the Air India Flight. This is written by Vivian Ho and Supriya Kumar, the article appearing in the June 13, 2025 issue of the Washington Post. And we began, an investigation team has inspected the wreckage of Air India Flight 171. This was took place June 12th, a day after it crashed in a residential area in the airport in Ahmedabad, India. Only one person on board Air India Flight 171 survived, British national Vishwashkumar Ramesh, who could be seen limping past a crowd of shocked rescuers toward an ambulance shortly after the crash killed the other 241 passengers and crew members, as well as dozens of people on the ground in Ahmedabad. Ramesh, 40, has been described as the miracle in Seat 11A in British media, and several top Indian officials, including Prime Minister Narendra Modi, have visited him in the hospital. I don't know how I survived, Ramesh said in an interview from his hospital bed with broadcaster Doordarshan on Friday, with one arm heavily bandaged and a bloodied cut under his eye. And that, by the way, was Friday, June 13th. I was on the side of the plane that crashed on the ground floor of the hostel, he said, adding that both the emergency door and his seat were broken in the crash. When the door broke, I saw there was some space for me to get out. That's how I escaped. The other side of the plane was stuck in the hostel wall. No one could have been able to escape from that, he added. The plane crashed into a college hostel shortly after takeoff. And so Graham Brathwaite, director of aerospace and aviation at Britain's Cranfield University, has called Ramesh's survival extraordinary. And there you go, my friends. That concludes today's journey on Armchair Traveler. We hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. Now, if you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.